This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collett. Welcome to The First Time.
Catherine, it's here. It is our final episode. And we saw each other in real life.
I know. That was so much fun.
It was so much fun. Really, I felt like we should have recorded it for posterity, but there was a lot of off the record.
There was just a lot of off the record.
Lots. This is a very big mega ep. So if you're doing, I don't know, like doing your Christmas tree or something, sit down and listen to this. We're going to wrap up the podcast. We talk to our agony aunt, Charlotte Wood, and we have an interview with literary superstar, Maxine Beniba Clark, to take us out. Woo!
Which I haven't gotten to listen to yet. Is it like...
It's ace. She's ace. I was really nervous, but she's really ace.
Yeah. No time for idiots, I reckon.
No. Nah.
Lucky you're not an idiot.
Lucky. I didn't know what you would, where you were going with that, Catherine. Okay, so this year I went back to the spreadsheet. I had to do some editing because we haven't been entirely up to date with that. But in total, we released 56 episodes and had nearly 50,000 listens.
Oh my
so
God.
If everyone could just... do a little bit more listening over the summer break, I'm pretty sure we are going to hit the big 100,000. I don't know. That must be at least a story on Instagram or something that we'll do for that part.
Wow, that's cool. We probably won't know about it. We'll both be out of radio range.
Oh, we will. And won't that be delightfully satisfying?
Just fall spontaneously from the sky.
So we did a few different things this year. We were meant to go to Brisbane to the amazing Avid Reader that never happened for obvious reasons. So we didn't get to do that, but we did get other things. So we did our conversations with friends.
Yeah, which that counts in that 55 episodes, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. So that was 22 episodes featured 45 different creatives in conversations about their writing lives. That was amazing. We did Apollo Bay Festival, which we've never done before. So we partnered with Apollo Bay and we helped them to get their online festival experience out, which was amazing. And then you did?
Darabin Fuse Festival, which was interviews with local Darabin council area based artists.
Which I feel is just like you going around the streets near your house, stalking your creative idols.
I did a thing, which I think I've mentioned on the podcast before, with Darabin last year, which I think they have run multiple years in a row where they get 12 local writers and artists to...
Oh, that's right.
You did the response thing. I did the egg.
That's right.
You just have to walk out on the street around here and you'll find someone.
You are overachievers in there. We, of course, began the year two with our very deliberate upskilling of ourselves in the amazing studio at Kathleen Syme, which we got to use about 3 times.
We did a lot of upskilling for that. We got Phoebe to show us. We attended all sorts of things. It was very impressive.
It was very impressive. You know what I'm impressed with, though? When we said, we're going to have to record from home for a little bit, we did not think it would be the whole season. And we have adapted. We're doing okay.
Yeah, it is a harder interview. I think that was a big adjustment at the start. Now I don't mind it. But the first few... to be stoners and back. That was a challenge.
That's true. One of the things
you can't.
Energy is different, but one of the things we did comment on the other night, probably only one Aperol spritz in, was the fact that what has been nice is because we have talked to each other like in the middle of our days, often we haven't had the whole thing of going into Carlton and getting a coffee and removing ourselves from our lives. That potentially we have been much more frank and honest about how things are going for us because we're just walking back into you to work, me to dishes, whatever else.
Yeah, that's true.
Silver linings, right?
I think there's just been a lot about life that's been harder too. Like that the frankness probably comes from the proportion of time that's...
What, are you saying 2020 was difficult, Catherine? Is that what you're trying to say?
Challenging.
Okay, so it's really hard. We always find this difficult. It's choosing between our children. Catherine, can you name just a highlight from your podcasting year? Is there a highlight?
Something that was really nice was, there's probably a couple, but talking to Christian White, which was right at the start of the year, I was meant to interview him the previous year, So I had met him at Storyfest, which is a fabulous festival on around Mollymook. Anyway, I had met him and I had written the interview questions after meeting him, and some of them referred to things that he had told me when we'd been in this car ride coming back from Mollymook to Sydney, but I had forgotten them. So when I went to do the interview, it was a really cool experience that I had these questions that were quite insightful or sparked good stories, but it was only because my former self had written them on the back of stories I'd been told.
That's so good. Congratulations, yeah. Former self. I feel like that should also put all writers in Australia on notice that if you have a conversation with Catherine and I on or off the record, that might come back to bite you in an interview, potentially.
Very good stories. Also, part of the Darabin, we interviewed McKinley Valentine, the newsletter writer, and I have fallen down her newsletter hole.
Yeah, you have hardcore kind of fangirled McKinley Valentine this year, and I love that very much.
Highlights at your end?
This was very, very hard for me, as it is for you. I keep coming back to the story that Tony Burch told about his childhood bike and just feeling like that was a highlight of my question asking this year because of the incredible response that it elicited. And I also like interviewing Kate Grenville. It was massive, massive highlight. And Nadi Simpson was just such a joy. I keep thinking about that. It's like that's the closest that I have felt that the screen wasn't there. And I think that came across. So I think, yeah, that was incredible. Best piece of advice or most interesting interview or recommendation? Like, was there just one little tidbit that we can give to listeners to take away?
Well, this was just a personal one, really, that helped me in the edits for my book. And it was a comment that you had made, actually, about the mother fault and the ending, and that you had to rewrite this ending a number of times, and that the problem was the climax, sort of two-thirds of the way, second act climax, wherever it was too high. Like it made it very difficult to surpass that. And that has been so helpful in looking at the structure of my own, because I have these decisions that are kind of inconsequential in terms of this is one version, this is another version, neither one is better. But to bring it back to that point of this one is better because the true climax comes at the right time. That has been super, super helpful.
So good. Can I just say to everyone, because I don't know, people maybe think that like we exchange drafts all the time or something. I have not seen this book and I am so bloody excited for when I get to see it. It's too much.
I'm coming. Oh, I'm going to throw it back to you. Best piece of advice? Most interesting interview recommendation?
I think I have to say that I have come back to Alice Robinson's advice, which is done is better than good. And it doesn't apply all the time, but where I've used it, and in fact there was a bit of argy-bargy on Instagram or Twitter or wherever he put it up with people kind of commenting.
I remember that.
Yeah, it was funny. But where it applies, I think, is like in this, you know, getting that draft zero down. Get it down. What you want to hit is 50,000 words. Then you want to hit 60,000 words. Just get the words down, because you cannot play and think with no words on the page. So I've kept coming back to that, and I think that was incredible.
That is definitely the context, because you can do that thing of, no, I'm going to get this sentence right. This sentence is going to be the best sentence before I put a second sentence.
No, there is a time for that, and it is not right at this time. Somebody who was excellent at giving pieces of advice, even if it was sometimes a little brutal, was, of course, our incredible agony aunt, Charlotte Wood.
This week's question for our agony aunt, Charlotte Wood, comes from Late Starter. Late Starter is 55 years old and attempting a career in writing. Her questions are, is it too late for me? Will I be considered an emerging writer? Most emerging writers are school leavers or a little older. Events and support networks for emerging writers seem to cater for this group. Where does someone like me go for peer support? And where do I find that person that I can check in with weekly, fortnightly, monthly? I do not have any writer friends.
Well, hello, dear late starter. The first thing to say is that you are not alone, because most of the teaching I've done is those classes are populated by women in their 50s or older, sometimes much older. And I think this isn't a coincidence, but it's just often the time of life when women particularly feel able to claim some space for their ambition and their desires, and their kids are old enough to get off their case, etc. So there are heaps and heaps and heaps of beginner writers in their 50s. And I applaud you for claiming that space and time. Now, I'm going to go to each of your questions. They're slightly hard to answer because, well, I think they're all actually the same question, and the answer is all the same answer, which is it depends on you. But I'll go through them one by one. So question one, is it too late for me? Well, too late for what, I guess, is my first response. In terms of a publishing career, maybe it's too late, maybe it's not. But that isn't to do with your age necessarily. It's to do with how hard you're prepared to work and how much time you're going to devote to self-doubt and wondering and, you know, being unsure of whether you're going to be able to do this. Clearly, when you're 55, as I am, you don't have decades to wait for the muse to descend and for your confidence to appear and for supportive networks to create themselves around you, even though, as we really know, none of those things ever happens on their own for anyone at any age. So I suppose what I'm saying is it's up to you whether it's too late. If you allocate your writing time wisely, if you draw some strong boundaries between your writing and the things that stop your writing, if you throw everything at it, it's not too late to write a book, that is. Success in terms of publishing is a whole other matter, but that's something nobody ever has control over, no matter what age they are. The first thing I thought of when I read your questions was a fantastic essay by Vicky Laveau Harvey in the Griffith Review of a few months ago. And the essay is called A Vapor Trail Across the Sun. And it is about publishing for the first time in her 70s, not just publishing a book, but winning the Stella Prize, then publishing internationally and having Margaret Atwood say things like, "The Erratics, Vicky's book, is a searingly, brilliantly written memoir." So there you are. There's a woman in her 70s. But the essay is interesting because it's about how her book came to be published, and more importantly, about the turning points for her in taking charge of her writing life and her book and forcing the world to make space for it. It's really inspiring, I think, for anybody to read. So I guess my specific answers to the rest of your questions are about this, claiming the space and taking charge rather than waiting for other people to do that for you. So question number two, will I be considered an emerging writer? My first response is, by whom? And who cares? I'm not sure who is sort of determining whether you're an emerging writer or not. But regardless, your job is to write your book. You know, do classes, develop your skill, put everything into the writing of your book. Really, who cares if emerging writers as a group are younger than you? They don't have your experience to work on. They might have more bravado than you, but that's an opportunity for you to learn what you can from them and their confidence that you perceive they have, because generally we're always perceiving that other people are far more confident, successful, blah, 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 than we are, as we've discussed before. And then just let go of what isn't helpful to you. Your age could actually be the best thing about you and your work. So you have a chance to use it for good, not use it to undermine yourself. Question three, where does someone like me go for peer support? Well, I actually think you know, because later in the question was long, we didn't read it all out, but you say how you've been to stuff at Writers Victoria and Varuna and so on. So I would say they're the places to go to: Writers Victoria, Writing New South Wales, Varuna, the Writers House, the Wheeler Centre, just community classes, wherever, social media, if that's your thing. So just go to those events and things rather than wanting assurance before you go that it's going to be the right thing for you. You won't know until you get there. And the last question is, where do I find that person that I can check in with weekly or fortnightly or monthly? I do not have any writer friends. Well, nobody has any writer friends when they're starting out, and they don't have writer friends until they make them. So this person, if you really want to find this person, will come from you going out into the world and finding them. You're already going to the places where, you know, when you've said later on, you say other people have these networks. Like, well, they only get them because they make them themselves. And they found them through the places we've talked about, those writer organisations. So maybe you need to take a step and invite someone else to be your writing buddy, or to, you know, have a coffee to talk about writing or whatever. But the other thing is, maybe you don't need this person. Maybe you don't need the peer support that you seem to be assuming that you have to have. If you want to write, the only thing stopping you from writing is yourself. You've said elsewhere in the letter that you are an introvert, and this makes connecting with other people hard for you. The thing is that all writers are introverts. Well, all the writers I know, and all the good ones especially, I think, being an introvert is not a disadvantage. Being an introvert is actually possibly the handiest kind of personality type to have when you're a writer. But if you do want peer support, you're going to have to go and find it or create it for yourself. Nobody goes around knocking on doors saying, is there a writer here that I can, you know, support with my network? You have to, if you really want to create connections with other writers, you have to just push past the introversion and ask for help. But again, there's no rule that you need a writing buddy, that you, if you actually don't want one, and maybe you don't want one, you just need to write. So I guess what I'm saying here is that all your questions are kind of the same question, and they all seem to me to be putting up a barrier to your writing that you want somebody else to take down for you. But of course, the only person who can take it down is you. And really the only person seeing them as barriers to your writing is you. So if you don't want to go find these peer support networks on social media or online classes or Varuna and so on, there's absolutely no rule that says you need them, because your best writing friends and teachers are books. They might be podcasts, they might be interviews with other writers. Those things can see you through a writing life just as well as any, you know, actual person in the world. So I guess this goes to a deeper point about the writing life in general, and that is that while peer support and writing buddies are fantastic and really helpful to many writers, not every writer has them and not every writer wants them. The number one thing you do need as a writer, more than talent, more than skill, more than networks, all of those things you can develop, but the thing you absolutely need is self-reliance. You need to be able to work alone. You need to be able to rely on your own sense of yourself, your own literary worth, your own courage and tenacity. And ultimately, that is what will see you through, not any of the other stuff. So let's suppose that either you can't find, you really can't find, or you actually don't want a peer support network. In that case, you can create your own accountability system. So maybe you could do this summer what a really good friend of mine, Ailsa Piper, did last year for herself. She said, I'm just going to make my own summer school. She worked out a schedule, a time and space and things to learn over the summer. So if what you need, for example, is, you know, narrative craft skill, find the internet is full of resources for free that you can just collate, get together, plan out your time and work your way through them. Create exercises for yourself. Set yourself goals of getting things done by when, and then stick it out. If you really do want and need peer support, then work out some specific steps to take to go and find them. Use the networks you've already made to invite other people to join you in a writing group or to somehow keep each other going. Some of those resources will cost you money. If you want them, you just have to find the money to get them, but they are not necessary. There's a gazillion online classes and resources for free. I'm going to put in a plug for a class that I taught with Tegan Bennett Daylight recently about sentences. That webinar is now online for free for anyone to look at through the University of Notre Dame. I would invite you to offer yourself the gift, total focus on your writing for the coming summer or the year. And you say elsewhere that you're not earning money, you're not working to earn money at the moment. In that case, you have the most amazing gift, which is time. And that's the biggest thing any writer needs. So I think you've got an opportunity to really go for it. I started writing seriously when I was 30. I know that's a lot younger than you right now, but the reason I'm saying that is to tell you how that happened. I could have started earlier. I had sort of dabbled and published a couple of little things, but then I kind of dicked around for at least 5 years, waiting for something to compel me to get serious. Then my second parent died, and that was the moment for me. I knew that now, definitively, that life is short. It was time to commit and to throw everything at it. So I changed the way I spent my time to make that commitment, because part of me knew that this was the most challenging, most interesting, most beautiful and enriching thing I could do with my time. It's the thing that I wanted to do for my life. So, you know, I had a full-time job, I had a partner, I had a whole lot of stuff that could have prevented me from getting into it and committing. But in my head, I made that commitment and I worked and I learned and I worked more. And the only difference between the me who wanted to write and the me who wrote was making that decision. So that was probably a lot more lecture than you were hoping for, late starter. But I just wish you good luck. I hope you don't waste any more time in worrying about this stuff and just take charge. And I wish you all the best.
Charlotte Wood, yeah. I think everybody loves your lectures. I think they love a little bit of a stern talking to by someone with deep wisdom and guidance. Charlotte, you just said that late starter should take this gift of total focus. And while we are desperately sad that our time with you as our agony aunt is coming to an end at the end of this season, can you please tell us the decision, the wise decision that our listeners can learn from that you have made about giving yourself the gift of total focus in 2021, please?
Well, thank you, Kate. I've so loved doing this. It's one of the things that I've loved the best through this weird year. But you're right in that I have come to a kind of realization, maybe that's why I was so lecturey to late starter, that I too have an opportunity next year to give myself total focus on my work. And that is something I've actually never done. I've always done public stuff, advocacy stuff, you know, teaching, whatever, often because I needed to earn money. But also because I, you know, wanted to support my writing pals and be in a community and all of that. And that's really has been super important to me. And that's why, you know, I came to you gals about the agony and thing. But I have just been worn out this year. One of the last things I've done was give a statement witness thing to the Parliamentary Inquiry into the Arts. I found that incredibly stressful.
And the act of doing it, or the kinds of things it was bringing up to, and the fact that it was advocacy on the behalf of so many people.
All of those things.
Yeah.
It was really stressful doing it. It was on the phone. You couldn't see anybody. To be honest, I felt afterwards so demoralised that it seemed that there was actually very little interest in what we had to say. Anyway, the preparation was really, you know, and it's kind of, it felt scary to do it, and it felt like a huge responsibility to convince our parliamentarians that the arts matter. And of course that was, you know, a vanity on my part that I was the one who had to convince them, but it just felt like a big responsibility and a very, very stressful one. And it came after, you know, done a lot of public stuff this year, and you know, it's the year that I had a book out from October last year to this year. You know what that, I mean, you have been, I don't know how the hell you've been doing what you've done, Kate. But it was just, and you know, I don't know, pandemic, everybody going crazy, etc. And I've had, yeah, possibly the best time of anyone in a pandemic, in that my income's been stable, I don't have to homeschool children, all of that. So, you know, I feel slightly like a wimp for hitting the wall, but I just hit the wall. So, and then I realized that actually I have an opportunity to choose a year of total focus on my writing. I guess I'm still haven't been very used to the fact that I don't need to earn other money, that I'm actually making a living from writing. And after 20 years,
incredible.
It's hard to come to terms with that in some ways. And I actually don't think that's a permanent state. So that makes it even more urgent for me that while I can, you know, instead of diluting my energy all the time by, I will be doing a few public things that I had already agreed to, and, you know, I wouldn't go back on those, but you know, that's about three, and in the last week I've said no to about five more. So
tell us logistically, because I'm interested in this, because you sent a delightful, very long, apologetic email to us to which we said, Charlotte, that's cool. That's great. Like, good decision. How do you logistically, have you got better this week at not being so apologetic, and how do you set yourself up so that you can say goodbye to all the stuff?
That's a good question. Look, part of it is psychological and part of it is logistical. The logistical part is easy. The logistical part is basically having a template email to send back to people when they ask me to do stuff. And I'm now sort of getting that well practiced, and I'm almost just copying and pasting.
Yeah.
And being very, you know, thankful that I've been invited, but explaining that I'm going to actually put, I'm kind of do an experiment for a year, going, what would happen to my work if I put all of the energy that I at the moment spend in 10 different directions into my work? And that's really exciting for me to think about. I also have a book coming out at the end of next year, a book of collected essay. It's, you know, it's stuff that I've been writing over many years, so it's not more writing that I've suddenly done. It's a book of collected essays. So in October next year, I will have to go into public again, and hopefully by then I'll be so rested that I'll be happy to do it. But actually the psychological thing is harder, and that is part of last week was really examining for myself, well, why, if I'm so tired of doing this, why do I keep doing it? So there's a few things that I sort of realised about myself. One is a kind of slight saviour complex in that, you know, well, I have to do this thing because all these people are depending on me. It's like, you know what? They're actually not. Most people don't really care whether you do it or not. That's one thing. Second thing is that, you know, it's instant gratification when you do an event or you write a blurb for someone's book or you do a bit of teaching, you get this instant feedback of people saying how great you are.
It's addictive. Kind of,
it's addictive. The adrenaline, I think, is also addictive. And I've always thought, I actually hate adrenaline, but I've realised that a part of me finds it energising until it's just completely draining. But, you know, I think I'll have to kind of watch myself that I might start going looking for that adrenaline instead of just getting used to a really slow, deep engagement with my work. Well, the other thing I did last week was put a note on my two social media accounts, my Facebook and my Instagram, saying, I said, and actually it was good, but I said, I've got an announcement, which is mostly to myself, which is I'm out of here. You know, love yous all. Please don't abandon, like, well, of course, if you want to, you know, stop following me, totally fine. But I'll be back at some point. But
it's I'm a not, great and I, template. It's an awesome template. I'm gonna
and the thing is, when you announce it, you can't, if you go back on it 5 minutes later and go, actually, you know, and you know, I have seen, I've had comments of nice things that people have said about my work internationally this week. I'm like, oh, I really want to go and say thank you to that person. But I've drawn a line and I've said, please, you know, and if you tag me and I don't respond, this is why.
Yeah.
And the other thing about that is, and I remember this years ago, I did a kind of digital detox for a week to write an article about it, which is another danger in, well, maybe I'll write an essay about how I'm not writing any more essays. And I know that week I had no email, no social media, no texting. I did a full-on detox, and my feeling all the way through that was, oh my god, when I get back online, oh, there's going to be this so much backlog of blah blah blah. You know what, there wasn't. And I've noticed, like, straight away within 2 days of me putting that thing on my Instagram, you know, first there's lots of really lovely comments, basically people saying, great, good for you, do it, go, see ya. Then after that, there's nothing. Nobody's going, oh no, where are you, why don't you come back? No one cares. They've got their own lives to live. So this sort of indispensability feeling is something that I think a lot of us develop. And partly we like it. We like feeling valued and indispensable. And of course we do. But I have this amazing opportunity to totally focus on my work and also things like my friends and my garden and stuff that do get neglected when you kind of overcommit yourself And those things are important.
Are you excited? Like,
I am. I'm terrified, a bit scared.
Like, yeah, both, I imagine.
Both. But even already, I have been feeling my book coming more alive to me in the back of my head than it has for most of the year. And not in that kind of panicky, I've got a week, so I've got to really work and produce and that kind of, and yeah, that's worked really well for me in lots of times, just sort of putting time away and having a really intense burst. And I probably still do that from time to time, but this is kind of me experimenting with a new way of working that is much more like what I used to imagine a writer's life was like, mm-hmm. when they can write full time and they can, you know, actually another thing that really helped enforce this for me was Helen Garner's statement to the parliamentary inquiry, which she talked about, it's not just the time, it's the thought of time that writers need. Now, you know, most of us, for 100% of our writing life, will not get that sort of time. But I have an opportunity to have that sort of time. If you can look up her, it's in the Hansard, her statement, and yeah, it's really beautiful. But she talks about the need to wander around the world looking and absorbing and thinking and not even writing, you know. So I just feel like, God, I have this chance for once in my life. I would be insane not to take it.
We will, when you have to get back on the publicity pony in October, we will check back in with you, even if it is only via email, and say, Charlotte, how did it feel to focus? And you have been, I know from the feedback we've got, Catherine, that people have loved your wisdom and your stern talking to of them. And no,
I could
doubt
get really addicted to that, honestly, bossing people around.
So thank you. We loved it. You're an ace agony aunt. You're welcome back anytime.
Thank
good
you
luck.
So much. And lots of love to all your amazing writer listeners and to both of you. And Catherine, so exciting about your book coming along soon. Mm-hmm. And I'll be watching and listening and reading.
Maxine Beneba-Clark is a widely published Australian writer of Afro-Caribbean descent. Maxine's short fiction, non-fiction and poetry have been published in Overland, The Age, Meanjin, The Saturday Paper, The Big Issue and many more. Her critically acclaimed short fiction collection, Foreign Soil, won the ABIA for Literary Fiction Book of the Year 2015 and the 2015 Indie Book Award for Debut Fiction, was also shortlisted for numerous awards. Maxine has published 3 poetry collections, including the prize-winning Carrying the World, and her memoir, The Hate Race, was also critically acclaimed. The Patchwork Bike, Maxine's first picture book with Van T. Rudd, was a CBCA honour book for 2017. Her latest picture book is the glorious When We Say Black Lives Matter, out right now in Australia and in the UK and US in 2021. Maxine Beneba-Clark, it is such a thrill to finally speak to you. Congratulations on When We Say Black Lives Matter. It's a glorious book.
Thank you, Kate. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Now, I want to talk about the book, but I want to go back first. So I want to know first, Maxine, when did you know in your bones that you wanted to be a writer?
I think I probably wanted to be a writer in high school, but it seemed to be this, I didn't know any writers. You know, books were these things that kind of magically appeared in the library. I had no concept of how to go about becoming a writer. So it was kind of, it felt very whimsical at the time. Like, oh yeah, I'd like to be a writer, kind of theoretically. And then I ended up doing a creative writing course at university. So that kind of, I guess, solidified that, yeah.
And were you getting things published during that time, or did you have anything, did you see your words in print while you were in school or during that creative writing course?
I remember we started, I think it was a year 10 or year 11 kind of a newspaper. There was one particular English class that was like all the kids that were interested in literature, yeah. And they got us together and said, let's start a year level newspaper kind of thing. And so I remember publishing some poetry, terrible poetry.
As it always is in year 10.
Yeah. In that publication, and thinking, oh, wow, this is, you know, that big difference between, I guess, when I was at school as well, showing my age. You know, I was like, oh, wow, we get to go on the computers and print out this thing. print it up, yeah.
With the weird font, like however you could do the font for the title. I know that pretty early on in your career, you became quite involved in the spoken word movement. Can you tell us a little bit about how that kind of has shaped your writing, or the impact that that's had on your writing career?
Yeah, when I finished uni, I still had no idea how to go about submitting work. I didn't even really read literary journals. I wasn't that familiar with them. And then I was writing a bit of poetry, and I'd gotten involved with a company called Hook, Line and Sinker, which was this kind of amateur theatre company out in Sydney's West producing original works. And because of that, I think I wrote a couple monologues for them, for people to perform. And then I saw this ad for something called the Glee Books and New South Wales Writers Centre Poetry Sprint. And you got 60 seconds to deliver a poem.
Wow.
And the prize was, I think, like a $400 voucher for Glee Books or something. So I was like, 60 seconds for $400?
Go for it.
So that was my first experience, really, of spoken word. I'd never performed anything.
Get the voucher?
Yeah, I got the voucher.
Yes.
And it was this weird, I remember at the time, I think I had a one-year-old, so it would have been like almost 14 years ago. And I remember, he wouldn't have been one, he would have been maybe 6 months old. And I remember like feeding him, and I had this narrow window of time to get in a taxi, get to New South Wales Writers Centre, perform this poem, and then get back home before I woke up.
You were on fire. You were ready for that 60 seconds.
And I think, you know, that really brought me into the spoken word scene. I started looking for other poetry slams and other open mic readings. And I think what that did, you know, that world is brutal, because you're performing, you're reading something for your audience, often something you've never read to anyone, or maybe you've read it to your mum or your partner or a friend. And that, I think, ability to see on the faces of the audience members that they don't like the work. You know, you might get 30 seconds into a 3-minute poem and no one in the room is going on the journey with you. So you're going, uh-oh, you know.
That's so interesting. It's like how you hear comedians talking about, you know, the brutality of stand-up and seeing the audience. Do you have that audience kind of in your mind when you're composing works at other times?
I think that's probably partly why I think more about who is going to read this, how are they going to read it. I mean, that spoken word stuff was a lot about, okay, I want to write something that, you know, often has a political message behind it or is about something I care about, but I want to make sure that someone sitting in the corner with a beer who does not care about what I'm talking about, that there is still somehow something in it for them. You know, maybe it's the rhythm, you know, maybe it's the way that it's written, the form that it's written in, you know, maybe it just sounds catchy, has a catchy refrain. And so I do think a lot about that, not just in terms of who would I like to read this, but if somebody completely different to them picks this book or this piece of work up, is there something in it? You know, why would they keep reading?
There's such a story about how your first collection, Foreign Soil, came to be published to win the Unpublished Manuscript Award. Can you just tell us how you were working on that, how you submitted it, the kind of craziness that happened after that? How long had you been working on those stories?
So I've been working on those stories, gosh, probably about 5 years. I'd previously published with a very tiny press, you know, very tiny meaning one guy in Warners Bay in New South Wales with a printing press in his shed kind of thing. Yep. So I published about 3 small poetry collections with Piccolo Press, they were called. And then I'd moved on to writing short fiction and worked on this, not knowing really that it was a short fiction collection, just deciding, okay, I'm going to try my hand at short fiction, and wrote these stories over the period of 4 or 5 years, and then sat down with this stack of stories and thought, you know, 10 or so of these seem to be on the same theme and seem to be talking to each other, and that became the collection that was Foreign Soil. And I sent it out, I was sending the stories out individually to literary journals.
Yep.
And also sending the manuscript out to publishers. So I think I would have sent it to about 20, 20 or 30 publishers.
You have a plan? You know, did you have the spreadsheet that you were going down? Were people recommending? Were you going to your favourite publishers, or were you just like all in?
Yeah, I was going to places I thought would be interested. And what was really interesting was that when I finally had publishers interest, it was not those publishers who were interested. So I was going to indie publishers. You know, I won't name any of them, but you know,
they are very upset that they passed. Let's say that.
You know, that I thought, you know, this is probably going to be a niche book because it's in a, you know, it's a short fiction collection set all around the world with African diaspora protagonists. I'm trying to get it published in Australia. Kind of the question was, who is going to be willing to take a punt on this? And I got a lot of, you know, your writing is really good, but, you know, basically, who is going to be interested in this? And a lot of shock, like, wow, this is this is quite a book, you know, veiled kind of feedback. And I was actually really close to giving up. In fact, when I entered the manuscript in the Unpublished Manuscript Award, I thought, this is the last thing I'm going to enter because I've spent so much time. And I remember at the time I didn't have a car and I had to get it, you had to send three bound printed copies. And I remember riding to Officeworks on my bike to get these printed and it started pouring with and I was like, this stupid manuscript and the things I'm doing. And, you know, maybe I should just chuck this in the bin. It was really one of those ridiculous situations. And then, you know, when they rang me to say that I was shortlisted a couple months later, I actually thought it was a friend of mine playing a prank. I was like, yeah, sure it is, sure, you know. And, yeah, so it was one of those situations where, you know, I would definitely have kept writing, but I was ready to just put that one under the bed and think, you know what, maybe it's not the one. Yeah.
And that one, you know, Foreign Soil went on to enjoy such success critically, you know, all those readers that those publishers thought they wouldn't find, it has found them and more. How did you navigate those next couple of years? Because I know that then the invitations and the awards and the festivals went on for, you know, quite some time after that. How did you kind of navigate going to this, the public world of the author and that kind of performative place, as well as trying to do life and writing and work?
It was a real surprise. You know, I had this conception, I think, as a lot of writers do, that once this book came out, I would be able to sit in my room as the kind of antisocial hermit that I like to be and just write. Yeah. And that would be my life. That's what being a writer is.
Sure.
And then you put a book on the shelf and people buy it and then you write the name. You know? Yep. But of course, particularly in Australia, you have to sell the book. And I don't think I was quite aware. You know, I had a lot of experience appearing publicly because of the spoken word.
Yeah.
But delivering work to someone, which is essentially, you know, the gift, if you will, of your work, is different from talking about your work.
Yeah.
And I don't think I'd quite prepared myself for that. And hadn't even really read anything. You know, I'd been to author panels myself, but I don't think I'd really read or listened to writers talk about that aspect of their job. So I think that was what surprised me. You know, at the time Foreign Soil came out, I had a 2-year-old and a 7-year-old, a single parent as well. And so it was like, on the one hand, all of these invites are coming in from festivals. I was even getting some international invites, you know, by the end of the first year. And it was like, my mum lives in Sydney and I was just ringing her up every week going, is there any chance you could take time off work and fly, you know? And I remember just before the book came out, I put an email out to this Artists of Colour email chain that I was part of. And I said, I'm looking for a Mary Poppins.
Did you find one?
I did. Like someone replied who said, I'm a friend of a friend of a friend. And, you know, I don't have that much experience looking after kids, but, you know, I'd love some work or whatever. And I went and had a coffee with her and she was an absolute godsend.
Oh, that sounds good.
I was definitely like essentially taking appearance fees and handing them to the babysitter.
Yeah.
So it wasn't necessarily financially viable in terms of that, but just knowing that there is this one person I can call. And, you know, after the first month or so, my kids just loved her. In fact, she still is my person to call if I have an event. And so, yeah, just that was really important to me, was getting that network of, you know, both my mother and, you know, this babysitter who kind of arrived out of nowhere as this godsend, and friends, and, you know, even just saying to someone, look, can you stand outside with the stroller for an hour while I do this kind of thing?
Yeah. Have over time, you know, you're obviously, your work and the expectations on you and the kinds of requests that you get will have just grown exponentially since then. Have you kind of had to put in place some criteria or boundaries about what you say yes to and the extent of that kind of public work that you do for each book?
I definitely do. And I think not just for each book, but just work in general. I mean, I feel like I could essentially work for 5 years without putting out any more work and survive that way. And so it's that tug of war between, you know, needing to pay the rent, so to speak, but I need to be creating. I want to be creating more work because this is what I want to do. And I think I think writers of colour tend to be funneled into the opinion writing sphere as well. And that was a really big thing for me for years. Not so much now, because I think people know enough that there's no point emailing me, but something would happen, you know, the Serena Williams racist cartoon or, you know, whatever it was. And I'd get all these emails saying, can you write us an opinion piece? We need it by next week. And I think, well, yes, the check will be good this week, you know, if I do that. But that's not what I want to do. Like, I feel like I've had to fight to say, no, I'm a creative. I'm not, you know, a journalist. I'm not an opinion writer. And that was hard because that was the more financially viable option. And so I think, you know, in some sense, all writers have those choices to make. But I think that was the hardest thing for me, was saying, you know, do I do this, which is going to make it a bit easier on my whole family, or do I say no and spend that day working on another short fiction piece or whatever?
One of the ways in which you were able to combine the creative with the moment, I suppose, was in your work as Poet Laureate for the Saturday paper, which was so enjoyable for all of the rest of us. You show this incredible skill in kind of distilling a moment in each week. And I'm really interested in that process that you went through each week, both to touch on and to find exactly what you were going to write about, and then to turn that over so quickly. What was that like? How did you do it?
Oh, it was ridiculous. I mean, I've been writing, I mean, one of the jobs that I kind of went, okay, this is, you know, this is something that's in the newspaper sphere, but that I can kind of do, it's more creative, was, so for about 5 years on and off, I wrote something called Portraits for the Saturday paper.
That amazing.
Portrait. So it was, you know, you'd sit down with a really interesting person, whether it was someone in your life or, you know, a celebrity or a writer or an athlete, and you would do a portrait of that. But I was able to do that in ways that were really creative, you know, like I could have written them as a poem, or I could have written them as a, you know, in whatever format I wanted. So I did that for about 5 years. And then I kept kind of saying, oh, you know, I don't really want to do that anymore. And then they'd ring me up and say, oh, we've got Marsha Gessen. Do you want, like, tempting me back?
Yeah, as they will.
And it got to a stage where I said to Eric, the editor at the time, no, I'm done. Like, I've spent 5 years doing this. And it got to this weird stage where I would be interviewing other writers and they would be asking me, oh, Maxine, can you sign my, like, the status quo had kind of changed. I wasn't just this random person. So I kind of couldn't pull any of the tricks that I used to pull in my interviews because they knew me. So it kind of also wasn't viable in that sense. So I kind of said, I pitched the idea. You know, I said, you should have a Poet Laureate. Like, and it was one of those pitches where I think it was just this random text message chain. I was like, this is what we're doing next year. I'm going to be your Poet Laureate and I'll write a poem.
I love it.
I got this text back about an hour later saying, we'll talk about it in the office and get back to you. And I went, what? What's happening? And then about 2 months later, when I thought, no, this idea is never going to fly, they said, yep, we're going to do it. We'll do it for the whole year. You'll have, you know, this amount of space every week and you'll have to, you know, this is how we'll do things. And so that's how that came about. It was just one of those wacky ideas that came to fruition. But, you know, the paper prints on a Thursday night, comes out on a Saturday morning, and they would give me my topic on usually a Tuesday.
Wow. Tuesday morning,
and it was supposed to be filed by Thursday. So it was 48 hours.
Wow.
And sometimes I would choose my own topic, you know, yep. and say, oh, this is happening, you know, whether it's an election or, you know, yep. and it's, yeah, we're really happy with that. But sometimes it would be, because it's a weekly newspaper, the news cycle is so fast. Sometimes there would be something that they weren't able to cover through journalists.
Sure, okay.
Let's say, can you write about robo-debt? Or can you write about the Banking Royal Commission? Or, and I'm going, I know nothing about this. But I somehow have to construct, and it's a poem. So, you know, it has to work aesthetically. It has to work lyrically.
On so many levels.
I have to say something. So, yeah, I would have pretty much 48 hours every week where I barely slept because I was just trying to come up with something. And, yeah, but it was, and that's why, like, in the end, I said, I can't do this for another year. Like, yeah. I just, it was a dream come true in a way because it was, you know, I mean, it wasn't a full salary job because obviously I was just writing one poem a week, but it was a regular income
yep.
doing something I absolutely loved. But also I did not produce any other work in that year because it was such an intense time. And so, yeah.
Because, and that brings me to asking you about how you make the working week, the writing week work for you. I've read that you've talked about the versatility and knowing very early on that you could not make a living from writing books of poetry. And often, you know, in writerly circles, your name will come up as, you know, gosh, wish I could do what Maxine does. Like just that incredible range that you cover. How do you make the writing week work for you? Kids are in school. Like what, do you sit down at 9 o'clock and start writing? What happens?
Look, I think because Foreign Soil came out when I still had one child at home and had one child at home for the next 3 years, I was writing at night pretty much. So, you know, I'd try and get the kids to bed as early as possible and then I'd write till kind of 2 o'clock in the morning and that was my writing time. And I've actually found that really difficult to break.
Mm-hmm.
I have to force myself. And now, you know, my youngest is 10 now. So she's been at school for, you know, 5 years and I've still found that really, really difficult. And I think it's also because before I had children, you know, I was working full time yeah. in a salary job, so I would also work at night. And there's something about those quiet hours where you know no one's going to call, hopefully no one's going to get out of bed and, you know, ask for a drink or whatever. And it's, yeah, it feels like, what else could I be doing at this? You know, isn't that? And so I found that hard to break. And so I found the exception would be working on kids' books.
Yeah.
You know, illustrating, I can kind of do that. I actually find the day is better for that. And so, yeah, during the day is mostly, you know, research or I might jot down ideas. I'll do, you know, I feel like my job is 60% admin.
Yeah.
So, you know, answering people's emails or sending off invoices or
mailing out. I remember reading an interview you did with Madeline Dorr for Extraordinary Routines and you saying that you scheduled all your meetings back to back in the one day, and it was just about the time when I was trying to kind of navigate taking off some time from paid work to write. And I remember thinking, that's it, that's what I'm going to do. And just tried yeah. to emulate that, just meetings back to back on one day. Have you been able to maintain that?
Not, I feel like I can maintain it when there's no book coming out.
Yeah.
So, you know, when we say Black Lives Matter came out this week and all of a sudden it's like everything is all over the place.
Yeah.
Like, okay, I've got to talk to this person at this time on the radio and then I've got to mail these books and I've got to, you know, so everything's all over the place. And I find I'm so unproductive. Like I suppose what I try and do is, yeah, one kind of thing. Like I might say, okay, before 1 o'clock today, I'm only doing admin and organising my emails because otherwise my efficiency is just
yeah,
all over the place. I find I get hardly anything done. And even if it means that, you know, these five people have to wait an extra 2 days, I just think, you know what, it's, you know, and I always have to remind myself, people can't see what's happening at my end. Like, I always have those freakouts and go, oh, I'm so unprepared. Oh, my goodness, this was it. And I'm like, hang on. They won't know. You know, I'm just going to pick up the phone and pretend everything's cool.
Everything, absolutely. I love getting that little insight into it too that you put out on Twitter, like, photographers coming, this is what we are now doing inside my house. I want to ask you about Twitter, but I want to go back to your new book. When We Say Black Lives Matter is just, it's so glorious and exquisitely balanced is such a overused word, but I think it is balanced. I loved what Jason Steger wrote about it, saying that, you know, you'd obviously said it had to show reality. It had to reflect the gravity of what the Black Lives Matter movement means to Black people and yet be okay for a child to read. And there is that weight and history, but also great joy in the book, in the words, and in the illustrations. When did you decide that you had to write this book and illustrate it, and how did you go about it?
I mean, I decided I had to write it during the first lockdown in Melbourne. So, you know, really after the killing of George Floyd, watching Black Lives Matter across, you know, Australia. And I mean, I suppose it wasn't a sudden, I know I will write a Black Lives Matter kids book. It's something that I'd always had this concept of, but I never thought I would actually do it. And I thought that if I did get around to producing one, no one would publish it. And I think it was a real moment of, you know what, now is the time. And I often feel like that about a lot of my projects, that it's not just about trying to create good work, it's kind of what is needed now, because that's what I'm interested in, I suppose, is being part of the conversation in a creative way.
I'm interested in the creative process that you go through for the illustration, and I've seen some of the little videos on social media of you doing the work. This is the second book that you've illustrated of your own. How does the creative process of illustration differ from your composing of the poetry or the prose, I suppose, in the book?
You know, illustration is so much fun. I was, when I illustrated my first book, Fashionista, which was, I think, came out last year, it was stressful because I'd never illustrated before. I'd always, you know, I studied visual arts at high school. I chose visual arts electives at university, but wasn't an artist in inverted commas. And so with Fashionista, it was really, what can I draw where I'm not going to have to draw lots of different things? Like, I almost made the book around my capabilities.
Yep.
And I kind of thought, you know, I can use bits from fashion magazines and I can use collage and I can use, you know, I guess I had that idea of those paper dolls that you used to get and dress up, and that they were quite simple. So it was kind of, you know, just bodies in movement with these clothes on them. But it was still very stressful because it was like, I don't know what I'm doing, and I would do a picture 20 times and not be happy with it. And but this one was different because I think I'd had all of that practice. And I'd also, actually, before I started working on this, I'd started work on another kids' book project. I probably was illustrating it for about four or five months on and off. That hasn't, I don't know if it will ever come together. It's just kind of in a drawer somewhere. I lost the passion for it halfway through, but it developed my illustration skills. So with this book, I didn't sit down and think, how on earth am I going to do this? It really was a joy because I was like, I know what materials, I know what style I'm using. I think it's the creative process for me with illustrations is more uncertain.
Yeah. Okay.
So I might have, I'll have the text in front of me, which is, you know, with a kid's book between 200 and 350 words, not long.
Yeah.
And I'll pull out lines and sometimes I'll think, okay, this line has to be a group of people protesting on the street, or, you know, this line has to be a mother holding. Sometimes it's really clear what that line needs to do. And sometimes it's, okay, this particular line, you know, there's a line in Black Lives Matter, trouble still stalks to this day. And, you know, that could be so many different images. And so thinking about, what am I talking about when I say trouble? I'm talking about, you know, police brutality. I'm talking about inequality. And I guess I wanted this book to, like, working out the layers on which you want it to work. So that page ended up having a picture of a mother and a child kind of bending down towards a police cordon tape. Mm. And so that idea that that line, trouble still stalks to this day, there's a whole other story that's brought through the illustration. So I think conceptually a bit more about what does this line say or this page say? Do I need to add anything in it by the illustrations, or can I just illustrate it, you know, like literally what's in the text? And also I think the balance of my instinct with illustrations is to do abstract things.
Yep.
So a balance of going like, oh, I've just had shadowy faces on this page. I can't do that for five straight pages. I'm going to need to, because it's for a small child, so, you know, I'm going to need to bring it back to the family kind of the next page. And so there's a lot more, I think, outtaking in my illustrations, probably also because I'm very early, you know, it's only the second book. So there's almost like a whole nother four books worth of artwork that didn't win, either because it was, and even silly things like I don't really storyboard. So some editors will sit down with a publisher and say, okay, so in this page, the kid's going to be walking to school, and in this page, they're going to be playing with the soccer. And I don't do that. I just kind of go, this is the general emotion of the book. And then I'll sit down and put them all together with the text, and I'll go, oh, there's five orange pages in a row. So just silly things like that, that I go, that drawing is actually perfect, but it can't go in the book.
What happens then for you in that kind of design and the editorial, I suppose, process that happens? I don't know if you call it editorial when it's with illustrations, but when you're working with the publisher then, how's that experience? I heard you talk about it briefly with Astrid earlier this week, or last week with the State Library. I suppose that you're used to having your words edited. What's it like doing that process with the illustrations as well? Because it's like your whole baby then.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting because I feel like with Van, with the Patchwork Bike, and the Patchwork Bike is my first picture book illustrated by Van T. Rudd, and the next one, Wide Big World, was illustrated by Isabel Knowles. And I think they both, because they were illustrators in inverted commas, the publisher said, okay, we're going to have a storyboard, you know, send us a, you know, I think it's 15 double page spreads, you know, in a standard size kids book. So we actually knew exactly what was going to be on most pages. So they might say, well, this on this page, this on this page, and there are six pages, you can just do what you want kind of thing. And I guess they didn't do that with me, partly because I handed them the text and just said, I'll send you the illustrations when they're done. And occasionally would send them, you know, this is what it, or send them a few pages saying this is the style. And I think that's probably worked really well, because I think if I tried to explain this book to them at the beginning, they would have gone, what on earth? I would have been like, and there's stained glass windows, and there's going to be this abstract protest scene at the front. You know, it would have just sounded like, this is a kid's book. Don't get ahead of yourself. And so I think that's, you know, leaving me to just kind of make the work. I wouldn't have been opposed to if they'd said, we don't think this page quite works. But also this one was created very quickly.
Yes.
It was like, they were like, we just need to print it.
It's extraordinary and you know, incredible, and for the US and UK release next year, just incredible to watch how quickly it's come out and into this extended moment. I've heard you read parts of it aloud in some little bits on social media, and I'll link to them as well. And it's always, whether you're, you know, delivering a keynote or reading a picture book, it's always such a joy to hear you perform your work out loud. And I'm wondering, at what point, if ever, when you're composing, do you read the work aloud to yourself, or is it just inside your head that you're doing that?
Definitely with kids' books, I do, because you know they're going to be read aloud.
Yep.
And so, you know, there are things that I'll read them aloud a couple times. You know, I mean, I read them aloud a lot, actually, you know, each draft. And there are things that I'll change because I think, oh, that rhythm is just a bit awkward.
Yeah.
And I think particularly on a topic like Black Lives Matter, I wanted it to read easily and to roll off the tongue and to have, you know, some musicality to it, because really there was a question of, well, what am I going to do to get people through this difficult subject as well? But I definitely think that's part of why I love kids' books, because it is an act of spoken word in a sense. You know that they're going to be read out loud.
You do quite a lot of work with students, both because your work is studied in the VCE, so you do a lot of that work, I know, and now with your picture books as well. Do you enjoy that aspect of the work, being with young people and talking to them or reading your work aloud with them?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I don't think I could ever be a teacher. Hats off to teachers, oh my goodness. Because I like to, you know, have fun and then leave and hand them back. Go home to my own children. But, yeah, I mean, especially reading picture books to kids, you know, when I don't do a lot of primary school visits. In fact, I barely do any just because of time constraints. Yeah. And actually the only reason I have started doing school visits 3 years ago was because Foreign Soil was put on the syllabus. And I had teachers saying, we don't know how to teach this book.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know what, just this is going to be on the syllabus for 3 or 4 years. If I do one school visit or try and do one in every school, there'll then be 3 teachers in that school that have the confidence of, you know, teaching this book. And, you know, it's a very strange thing because I think my work is more relevant really than Shakespeare. You know, in terms of it's about, you know, any contemporary work really is more relevant than Shakespeare. And so, but yeah, there is this, I guess the English teaching workforce in Australia is largely white and middle class. And so there was that fear of what if I teach the wrong thing or what if I'm not, you know, using the right terms. And so really it was an act of extended dialogue with teachers. It started out as that. So I do like doing the school visits, but there's a sense in which as well you know, getting to the end, this year I think was supposed to be the last year Foreign Soil was on the syllabus, but it's been rolled over because of, so they haven't changed the books. And I think I don't want to, I find myself getting a little bit bored.
Yeah.
Because it's like I've been talking about this book to kids for so long, and to maintain that level, at first it was like, wow, they're studying my book and this is so great. And, you know, so it's still nice, but I'm very wary of being boring.
Yeah, it takes an enormous amount of energy. I just want to quickly ask you about The Hate Race, about your memoir. In an interview for the Stella Prize, you said, I don't think I've ever thought as much about the way I craft my work as I did while writing The Hate Race. Now, given that time has lapsed since then and that may have changed with different projects, what particular work was it with the memoir that you had to do it at a craft kind of level that was challenging?
I think I was very conscious of what I was trying to do with that book. So it's a memoir. It's about, you know, growing up as a Black African diaspora person in a middle-class white environment. You know, I'm bearing in mind that the primary reading work, readership in Australia are tertiary educated middle-class white people, you know, just by virtue of the makeup of Australia. But at the same time, I want a 14-year-old Black girl to be able to pick up this book and see this as their story. And so I suppose I was looking at it on those different levels of how would this read to me when I was young? How would this read to my next door neighbor? How would it read to the person in the shop? Because really I wanted it to be a conversation starter and an open-ended kind of, here's a story, you know, you engage with it. And I think as well when you're writing on issues like race, trying not to be didactic, trying to just tell the story and not kind of go, this is terrible, you know, this is awful. And so I think it's a real, whenever you're writing about anything that's emotive or that you're personally invested in, it's really hard not to, and sometimes you don't have to, you know, so with the work I was doing with the Saturday paper, it was just like, this is just basically what I think, you know, I'm just going to go for it. But with that book, it really was, how do I want this to read? And I'm thinking about in 20 years' time, you know, how do I want this to be read by people looking back? You know, people often say, oh, do you get, you know, writers of colour often get trolled or, you know, doxxed in the media and things like that. And, you know, there's this sense in which anything in book form or in poetry form, it's like it has an invisibility shield around it. wonderful thing that, you know, it's not that you don't get those kind of responses where people say, you know, this book is racist in itself or whatever, I'll send you an email, you know, off an aggressive email, but there's a sense in which, and I think this is also why I try and stay out of that kind of opinion space, although the poetry was leaning towards that in the Saturday paper, is it's a work of art. So first and foremost, you're asking people to look at it as a work of art, and then, you know, the content is just there. And so I think, you know, that's the wonderful thing about The Hate Race is that, and I also think when people pick up a book, they're picking up in a totally different way than they're opening a newspaper or clicking an article, seeing something on Twitter. There really is that sense of, I am picking up this book because I want to read the story. I might not agree with it, I might not love it, but, you know, I'm open to it. And I think that's the beautiful thing that books do, is just create that space to have a conversation in a more gentler space than that kind of 24-hour cycle.
Mm. Let's talk about Twitter. You are an extraordinary presence, and I know that many of our listeners will know you as Slam Up from Twitter. You both engage and comment on topics, you know, ranging from politics, racism, lit kind of world happenings, and your annual and much loved reminder to people like me to check our school kids' bags for lunchboxes at the end of each school term. There's loads of arguments that writers and creatives put forth for both being on social media or absolutely staying the hell away. Why have you stayed, Maxine? And please keep staying, because we need you.
Look, I think I stayed partly because I increasingly work from home. And so it's like, you know, my kids leave the house at 8:30 and come in at 3:30, and I cannot speak to another soul in that time. Sometimes that's good if I'm working on something intensely, but it's just that lifeline to the world. And I think, you know, this wonderful full thing of being able to, I'm also, like, I'm not a very social person. People are quite surprised when I say that. But, you know, I just pretty much sit in my house and, you know, hang out with my kids and occasionally go and have a coffee somewhere. And so it's that sense of being connected to the wider world, I think. And, you know, there is writer Twitter, but then there's this whole other, you know, a lot of the people that follow me are just random people. You know, like I'll post something about my tomatoes and some farmer in Queensland will say, oh, you've got, this is the type of caterpillar that's eating them and this is what you need to do. And I think just that world, that global world of going, you know, this one account connects me to all these different people all over the world. I find it fascinating. I think what, you know, also in my work, what fascinates me is other people and yeah, just the lives of other people.
Before I let you go, I have to ask you if you've got any advice for writers who might just be starting out or who are, you know, thinking about chucking that manuscript that everyone's rejected and they don't want to put it into the manuscript award. What advice can you give to writers?
Oh, you know, I my instinct is to say just keep moving, keep going on, keep pushing. I mean, I do have an anecdote that before I started working on Foreign Soil, I actually worked on a novel called Black Lazarus, and it's a long story. But basically, a couple of years ago when I moved house, I found the manuscript for this novel, and it was terrible. There were some parts of it that ended up in Foreign Soil. So I think there were three sections that I pulled out and constructed into short fiction. But it was almost this horror of just flicking through the pages going, at the time, I thought this was genius. You know, I had a better conception of what it was than I had of Foreign Soil. You know, I was like, this is amazing, you know, mid-20s or whatever, writing this novel in inverted commas. And I had some small success with it, you know, got picked up for particular manuscript projects and stuff, and that had kind of, and so I guess my anecdote is keep pushing, but also be open to the idea that this may not be the one, you know? And so even with Foreign Soil, there was a certain amount of time where it was kind of like, I will give it X many years or X many months or whatever, and then I'm just going to, you know, put it in the drawer and maybe someone will pick it up later down the track. And so, yeah, keep pushing, keep finding the time to write. Don't be precious about when and where you write. You know, if it's just scribbling down, you know, a paragraph on the back of an envelope one day or whatever, that's still part of the creative process. And I think don't be overwhelmed by the task. So, you know, one sentence at a time, one paragraph at a time, one chapter at a time, that notion of starting a book in inverted commas is so huge that anything you can do to make it less overwhelming will help.
So good. It's like a masterclass right there from Maxine Benieber-Clark. Before I let you go, can you please recommend a debut book to us anytime, any place, any genre?
Yes, I'm recommending Where the Fruit Falls by Karen Wild. And this is a book I actually bought yesterday, so I've only read a quarter of it. But it's just, it's lyrical, it's beautiful. The characters are, you know, I have a real thing for characterization. And so the characters are, you know, three-dimensional. And, yeah, it's just, you know, Karen's a First Nations writer as well, but that's not why I'm recommending it. It's just, I think at the end of the year, I kind of, you know, walked into the bookstore and was like, I just need something that's going to be a lie in bed, sink into it kind of read. And I think this is it.
Definitely is. And I know we spoke to Karen last week. You can listen to her interview for our listeners and she will be thrilled, utterly thrilled that you're recommending it. Maxine, you've been on our wish list for so long to interview and it's just been so lovely to talk to you. Congratulations on your amazing new book, When We Say Black Lives Matter, and may it fly.
Thank you, and thanks a lot for having me on the podcast.
Before we go, an enormous thank you to our patrons via Patreon. There are 21 of you and you make life so much easier. You allow us to pay Phoebe, our producer, for each episode.
And Phoebe, you are amazing. Thank you so much for all your incredible work. And thank you to each of our guests this year who have just been so generous in sharing their stories. And of course, to all of you, our listeners, who really make up such an incredible community now. Thank you for sharing the love for the podcast and the guests, but also supporting each other.
We'll see you back for season four, 2021.
Season four. We did it.
Like, that's less for murder. I used to work with a woman that would say that for everything. It's a bit like that's what she said. Yes, next year, season four, my second book, Kate's third book, The Motherfold, comes out in the UK. That will be a very exciting moment. Hopefully we get a new cover.
Woo!
We may not go back to the studio.
Who knows? Stay tuned.
And we've got a really cool guest list already. I'm super excited about that. So happy summer, festive season. Merry Christmas. Do you have a festive wish?
Read lots of books.